Okay, so then we can start. So this today's sutta is called the Nagaravindeya Sutta, number 150 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's quite a short sutta, but it's a sutta we haven't done before, I think, here. So I always like to do suttas we haven't done before, just to kind of go through pretty much everything in the Majjhima Nikaya. And every single sutta has some interesting points to it. So as always, it's actually nice to have a look at them all. And you see how they fit nicely together. You see the themes kind of being repeated in one sutta here and there. And when it kind of all comes together, it becomes a very kind of beautiful whole, this puzzle of the suttas, all the pieces fitting together very nicely. So, Nagara Vindaya Sutta, to the Nagara Vindans. So this is how this sutta goes. So again, as usual, if you have any questions, please just raise your hand at any time as we go through this. So, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus, and eventually arrived at the Kosalan village named Nagaravinda. The Brahmin householders of Nagaravinda heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Kosalan country with a large sangha of bhikkhus, and has come to Nagaravinda. Now a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. The Blessed One is accomplished, full enlightened, etc. He reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. Okay, so this was one of the standard things that you see throughout the suttas. The Buddha was wandering around either in the Kosalan country or in Magadha, different places, and he would come to different villages, right, different towns. Then he would stop and he would kind of settle down somewhere, and the householder would come out because the rumor had spread around that he was a kind of a great saint at that time already. So let's have a look. I haven't actually added that to that sutta, but let's have a look at this rumor, because this thing which has been abbreviated here is a standard passage that you see throughout the suttas. And it's actually quite an important passage, and I'll show you. You've heard it before, every one of you, but it's still a very nice passage. And this particular passage is the standard passage that you see in the suttas on the recollection of the Buddha, right? When you have the recollection of the Buddha, remember when you come to the temple, you chant the Itipiso, right? Itipiso Bhagava. This is what this is. This is the Itipiso Bhagava, the standard recollection. And remember that the idea of these recollections, recollection of the Buddha, recollection of the Dhamma, recollection of the Sangha, etc., the idea of these things is to actually use them, right? To use them in your meditation. The thing about meditation only works if you have this kind of oomph, if you have the right perspective, if you have the right attitude. And these kind of recollections give you that kind of right attitude, right? If you think about the Buddha in the right way, it gives a sense of happiness and joy. Wow, there's this wonderful teaching there. Came from this teacher 2,500 years ago. So you inspire yourself. And when you feel inspired, you feel a sense of joy. And that is where that meditation really becomes possible. This is what is known as the Buddha Nusati elsewhere. And here it is just kind of the standard explanation for what the Buddha actually is. So remember, these things are actually very important things, and they have a very important place on the Buddhist path of meditation. So for that reason, it's useful just to have a quick look at it again. So this is the Itipiso formula. This is what it says. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of the worlds, incomparable leaders of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. That is the whole formula. That is the Itipiso, right? So how should we look at this formula to try to give us some inspiration? There's many ways you can do that, and it's really up to you to develop your own perspective on this and to understand what these words mean. But I'll give you some ideas how I look upon this so that you just give you some clues perhaps. So fully enlightened. I like the idea of awakened instead of enlightened. The Pali word is sammasambuddha, and Buddha means awakened, right? I like the idea of awakening better than enlightenment. To me, enlightenment doesn't mean so much. So awakening, right? Seeing the truth, turning on the light, dispelling the darkness, breaking out of the shell, seeing the world for the first time, awakening, awakening to something bigger and more powerful. This is the idea behind that. Samma sambuddha. Perfect in true knowledge and conduct. So this true knowledge here is the basically the understanding of the world as it actually is, right? The world is in a certain way. But very often the way we look at the world is not aligned with the way the world is. And because there's a misalignment, that's why it's called wrong view. The world is in one way, and we look at it a different way, and that causes problems. So true knowledge here is basically, there's three things that this consists of. This is the understanding of the idea of the process of rebirth, understanding your past lives specifically, understanding the laws that govern the rebirth process, the laws of karma, and lastly, the actual awakening itself. The actual awakening itself is just basically understanding that, understanding the nature of suffering, of impermanence, and of non-self. That's basically what that is about. And that is accompanied by the ending of all the defilements and the highest possible happiness, right? So you have, what this basically means is that you have a clarity about what the world is like. And it's very interesting that in the suttas, that clarity is divided into these three fields. And often they are, all three of them are actually very important. It's not just as if the actual awakening itself is important, but the understanding of past lives and understanding of karma is also considered here a very, almost on an equal footing with awakening. Not quite, because awakening is obviously the final goal, but the way it is described is almost on an equal footing because it pulls you in that direction. So these are the three true knowledges, because now you actually see the world for what it's actually like, right? That's powerful. It's a very powerful thing, this idea of seeing the world for what it's actually like. Because how can we make good decisions about our life? How can we decide what is really important, what really matters in the world, unless you have the right outlook? First of all, you have to look at the world in the right way. And only then is it possible to make decisions about what you should do, right? If you have the wrong outlook, which is called wrong view in the suttas, or micchaditti, it means that you can't really apply yourself in the right way because you don't understand what things are like. It's like investing in the wrong share on the stock market because you've got bad information versus investing in the right company because you have good information. One leads to suffering, the other one leads to happiness. So this idea that the Buddha is the eye of the world, right, who sees things as they actually are, is a whole thing which underlies the whole teaching of Buddhism. There is one person who is capable of penetrating the darkness and actually seeing what it's all like. And then he says, well, listen, I have discovered something. I think you may be interested in this, right? There's something interesting going on here. This is basically what's happening. This is going to be for your happiness and welfare. So I recommend, you know, it's advisable for you to listen to this. So that is the idea of vijja, of a high, what's it called here, of the true knowledge here, vijja in Pali, related etymologically to the word wit in English. The word wit in English has the meaning of being funny, but also means like quick-witted, right? Like smart or intelligent or sharp at the same time. It's actually related directly to that word. So he's vijja, but so he has the knowledge, the insight into the world. At the same time, he also has the conduct, right? It's the other important factor. Conduct and insight go together. The idea of crazy wisdom is not something you find in the suttas, whereby you're very wise, but you act in a crazy way. It doesn't work like that in the suttas. If you are wise, it reflects in your conduct. You act in accordance with that. So you will be peaceful. You will have compassion. You will have understanding. You won't get angry. You won't be full of desires and delusion. So you have all these good qualities. It reflects in your conduct. And of course, that's important because that's how we can decide who is worthy of confidence in this world. If it doesn't reflect in a karma, it's very hard to know, right? Who is worthy of confidence and who is not? Who is worthy of putting your faith in and who is not? And this is actually what helps that out, because the inner transformation is reflected in an outer transformation at the same time. So you can actually tell what is going on. So, perfect in true knowledge and conduct. Sublime. Sugato. Literally, something like good, happy, right? Sugato means literally well gone, but it means like having achieved a high state, right? That's basically what it means. Knower of the worlds, loka vidu. So this is the idea that the Buddha has seen the whole world, right? This is an important point. The point is that if you haven't seen the whole world, if all you have seen is a narrow part of the world, again, you have a problem with actually being able to decide what is right and what you shouldn't be doing, what you should be doing. It's only when you have the full overview of what is possible in the world that you can make right decisions about what to do and what not to do. So this is why the Buddha's, you know, the idea of rebirth from a Buddhist point of view is so important, because it shows that the scope for what is possible in this world is far, far more than what you might think when you're just a human being. You think when you're a human being, kind of life is limited to this world. But actually, Buddha says there's much more out there. There's much more scope for happiness and suffering than just in the human life. So it's this vast thing. And once you understand the vastness of it all, and once you understand the laws that govern the rebirth into the different realms, you understand the whole mechanism of the whole thing, only then can you really decide whether, you know, how, what you should be doing with this. So the Buddha then says, well, okay, so this is the world. Now, in this world, there are these dangers, and there's these kind of happinesses available. You balance the dangers and the happinesses. And what happens when you balance them? The danger is much more heavy, right? And this is why the Buddha talks about the ending of rebirth being the kind of the final purpose of the life of a Buddhist. Because the danger in this whole massive thing we call samsara, usually, all the potential rebirths and everything, the danger, the suffering, the problems, all that is much greater than the possible happiness you can have. So once you see that, you think, okay, I've got to escape from this. And that's where the ending of rebirth happens. So this idea that he knows the world, the full whole world, this is an important point. He knows the whole world and he understands the limitations and the benefits that are possible in that world. Okay, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. I prefer the translation, perhaps incomparable leader of tameable people. Right? So, tameable means that you are able to subdue yourself, you're able to practice the spiritual path. It doesn't mean some kind of slavery or anything like that. So you are able to tame your kind of defilements, right? Your desires, your anger. It is possible to tame that if you practice the gradual path. But certain people can't be tamed, right? I mean, you have to want to practice this path. You have to have an interest in the Buddha's teachings. If you haven't got an interest, if you can't see the point of this, and many people are like that, and people, why on earth would you want to do those things for? Of course, then it becomes impossible. So there's always only going to be a certain amount of people who actually find an interest in these things. At least now, of course, things will always change over time. And in the future, we might be the untamable people, right? This is what's so scary about it, because the mind is so changeable. You're wise in one life, you come to another life, and then you're stupid in your next life. You might be tameable now, but in the next life, you might not be tameable anymore. And this is the problem. So this is why the Buddha talks about the sense of urgency, right? Because wisdom and everything is always changing. Ideally, you hope that, you know, wisdom will kind of keep on going up and up from life to life. And sometimes that's true. But it all depends on where you are reborn, whether Buddhism is going down or up. Depends on all these different factors. And that is what is so worrying about it, right? Suddenly your mind changes. You look at things differently. And then you everything goes down from there on. So you have to be careful to remain tameable. Otherwise you fall into trouble there. Okay. Teacher of gods and humans. I think the point there probably is that, you know, even the gods in the world, even the higher beings, are basically find the teachings of Buddhism useful, because they don't have anything higher. So even they fall in under this. Enlightened, blessed. Anyway, so there is some of the ideas, right? The Buddha is an incomparable teacher in the world, incomparable leaders of people, of tameable people, right? So he's an incomparable teacher. Why? Because he has seen the truth, what it actually is. He understands. The Buddha has these two beautiful qualities. He has understood this, the true nature of suffering. And because he understands that, he has this he has compassion for people, because he sees that this is what everybody wants. Even though we're actually blinded, we don't understand what we want, the Buddha can see that this is actually what we all really want at the end of the day. And for that reason, he has a tremendous compassion. And the last 45 years of the Buddha's life, after his awakening, his whole life was basically run, motivated by compassion. He didn't have anything more to do, right? And all that drove him forward was compassion, because he understood the nature of suffering. Very powerful to think about that. You know, all of these suttas here, everything the Buddha said is motivated by compassion and kindness. There's nothing else that runs and drives someone who is a Buddha. It's a very beautiful thought. And not only that, is it run by compassion and motivated by compassion, but it is the compassion combined with the highest possible wisdom, right? The true understanding, as I was talking about before. That's a very powerful combination, the highest wisdom compared with the highest possible compassion. Very powerful thing, because it means that you have the motivating force to help others, and you have the ability to help at the very highest way. The wisdom gives you the ability to kind of, you know, to use that compassion to the maximum. So it's a beautiful thought. Try to use some of these thoughts in a meditation practice. See if you can kind of get to know the Buddha, get a feeling for this. One of the things I like about the suttas, I start to get a feeling for the Buddha after a while. Initially, the Buddha seems remote. You read the suttas, you think about this man who lived 2,500 years ago in a different culture. And you read the suttas and you can't really relate to them. After a while, you start to get a feeling for this person, who he was, right? He talks about his life. He talks about himself having defilements when he was before his awakening. And you start to notice that there is a pattern here. It actually looks a bit like us. It looks like who we are. And when you start to relate to the Buddha, then you say, wow, you can actually get a feeling for the qualities that make up the Buddha. And you know that we all have that potential inside of us. And you feel inspired. You feel, wow, something very beautiful and profound going on here. And that is, once you get that feeling inside of you, it can be this force in your meditation practice that you can use. Okay, so that is the Itipi So formula. So if you have the opportunity, please think a little bit about that, because it's very, I think it's quite nice. And you can learn the Pali words if you like, which can be quite useful as well. So that is, yes, we talk. Yeah.
These 10-4 conducts, what are they?
I think it's 14, 14 conducts. Yeah, it's listed somewhere in the suttas. I never took much notice, to be honest with you. I think the idea is just that he's perfect in his behavior. He doesn't display any signs of anger or desire or delusion, right? So his conduct is very... it's consistent with the mind state, basically. I think that's the main meaning of it. Okay, you can maybe break it down into 14 things, but I never really paid much attention to that, to be honest. I think it's only one place in the sutta, as is mentioned, the 14 charanas.
So true, but I forget where that is.
Yeah. Where is it again?
I think it's in the Majjhima Nikaya.
Somewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya. I think it might be in the Brahmayu Sutta. That lists all the conduct of the Buddha. 91, perhaps. Try that one. Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah.
When you say subdue or tame,
I mean, when you think about subdue, you sort of think of a police officer subduing a criminal or something like that. What do you mean by subdue, like in that context?
You mean tamed, right?
In that context, because sort of opinion of subdue is a sort of a forceful way.
Sure.
I don't think that. Yeah. In this context, it is forceful.
It isn't. You're quite right. That's an important point, and I think. This is one of the things you find that in the suttas, is that often the vocabulary, you have to be very careful with actually interpreting it right. And one of the things which is interesting, if you look at Majjhima number 19, it's called the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thought. And the Buddha talks about his own practice before his awakening here. And what it says there, he divided his thinking into two types of thought, the wholesome thoughts and the unwholesome thoughts. And then he has a method for overcoming the unwholesome ones. And it says that when he uses that method, the thoughts are obliterated. They are made to not cause, to not exist, obliterated. Some very strong word, terminated, I think, is some of the translations there, right? Very, very strong words. And it sounds like, when you read the English, it sounds like someone is kind of using the willpower and crushing this to pieces, right? That's what it sounds like, yeah. But actually, it is not at all. When you read the sutta, the Buddha says that he uses his wisdom for these things. He reflects in a certain way. And when he reflects in a certain way, he gets rid of those thoughts. He sees the danger in those things. He sees that they lead to the ending of wisdom, going away from nirvana. It is a suffering for himself and for others. And when he sees that deeply enough, that's all he needs to move away from that thinking. And that's... So that's wisdom, right? And what wisdom does, wisdom obliterates those thoughts. You can't obliterate them with willpower. We can maybe kind of, you know, hold them down for a while. We can't really obliterate them. The only way you can obliterate them is precisely with wisdom. Because wisdom, once you see correctly, the thought just disappears and vanishes like that. And it's the same thing going on here. The idea of taming yourself, again, it's... Not really. I mean, sometimes you have to argue. Sometimes there probably is a little bit of willpower, right? I mean, sometimes you go out, you feel that you feel in a bad mood, right? And you want to say something, but you realize probably I shouldn't say anything, so you hold back a little bit. You use a bit of willpower to hold back. So there's a bit of willpower there. But the ideal is always to use wisdom to overcome those things. That's always the ideal. So you're taming the mind basically through wisdom. What lies behind this? Yeah. Okay, very good. Okay. So that is the idea of right view. This is the idea of the recollection of the Buddha, the Buddha Anusati. And then we have the second part of this. And the second part of this is that once the Buddha has realized that, then he declares that to the world, right? He teaches this to the world. So he declares, this is what he does next, he declares this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with the right meaning and right phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure, utterly complete and pure. Perfect is not a good translation. Utterly complete is better translation there. Complete and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. So again, you can see here that what is going on here, he's teaching the whole world, right? Everything which is there, he teaches. This is what the world is like. These are the potentials. This is how far it goes. And of course, it is implied here. Of course, the law of karma is also implied because that's part of understanding the world as it actually is. And of course, the main point here is that he has realized this with his own direct knowledge again. So he has actually seen this for himself. He teaches the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. A lot of writing has been done to decide exactly what that means. But I think one of my favorite understandings of that phrasing is that it brings you results straight away. It brings you results in the middle. And it also brings the results at the very end of the path. It brings the results all the way through. And this is kind of the wonderful thing about the Dhamma. You start putting into practice, you get results straight away. And it goes all the way to the end of the path. And that's why it has this beauty all the way through it. And if it doesn't give results, then it's always good to try to investigate why not, what is stopping you from getting results. He revealed it's right meaning and right phrasing, meaning atta. Atta means like goal or purpose, right? So it has the right goal being the highest possible happiness or just happiness all the way along the path, culminating in the highest possible happiness, nibbana, extinguishment. So right meaning, right phrasing. The phrasing is important as well. The phrasing isn't arbitrary, right? He puts things in such a way that it is easy to understand. Every word has a certain meaning. Every word has a certain impact, a certain sense that is important to take into account. And then you reveal the holy life that is utterly complete and pure. So it's complete in the sense that it includes all the aspects needed to attain the goal that is talked about. And it's also complete in the sense that it leads all the way to the end, right? It has everything here, and it goes all the way to the end of the path. And it's pure in the sense that all the aspects of purity are talked about. This is a Buddhist idea which includes things like mental purity, right? Very powerful idea, this idea of mental purity. You don't really hear about that so much in other teachings or other religions or whatever. Anyways, that's just a summary of that thing which was left out from the sutta before. So just to give you that background, because the sutta today is quite short, so I thought we had time for that. Okay, so now back to the Sutta 150 again. So they think, now it is good to see such arahants, right? Do they know that the Buddha is an arahant? Probably not. They probably just say that for because they have faith or something. But they can't really know that. It's just probably just an expression of faith. Okay. Then the Brahmin householders of Nagaravinda went to the Blessed One. Some paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down to one side. Some exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. Some extended their hands in a reverential salutation, anjali, towards the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some pronounced their name and clan in the presence of the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Some kept silent and sat down at one side. When they were seated, the Blessed One said to them. So this is a standard passage. This happens seems to happen every time the Buddha goes somewhere. You get all these different people doing all these various things. Okay, so then the Blessed One gave them the teaching. And this is what the teaching is about. Householders, if wanderers of other sects ask you thus, householders, what kind of recluses and Brahmins should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated? You should answer them thus. Those recluses and Brahmins who are not rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye, whose minds are not inwardly peaceful, and who conduct themselves now righteously, now unrighteously, in body, mind, and speech. Such recluses and Brahmins should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. Why is that? Because we ourselves are not rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye. Our minds are not inwardly peaceful, and we conduct ourselves now righteously, now unrighteously, in body, speech, and mind. Since we do not see any higher righteous conduct on the part of those good recluses and Brahmins, they should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. The point here is basically who do you take as your teacher? That's basically the point of this whole sutta. This part here. The idea that you honor, respect, revere someone means basically that you go to them, right, and you listen to them. You listen to the Dhamma that they have to say. That's basically the underlying meaning. It's not just a matter of paying respect. It's a matter of taking their teaching seriously. Honoring someone means to take their teaching seriously. So this is about who should you choose as your teacher? Who should have spiritual authority, right? Who has spiritual authority in this world? How do you decide who has authority in these matters? I think that's a very important question. I went to a like a little discussion a couple few days ago regarding this particular, not regarding this particular thing, regarding some other things. That was one of the questions that came up. And this was a group with people from different backgrounds, some were Christians and all kind of things. And they asked this question, how do we decide who has spiritual authority? How do we decide who we should listen to? There's all these people going around saying various things. How can we make a decision? I think as Buddhists, we have a rough idea, but they were actually completely confused about this point, right? These were kind of Christian, most of them. So this is actually an important point. And because, of course, here Buddhism wasn't yet established in India at the time, it was obviously they were in a similar kind of boat, these people. They weren't Buddhists. They were just hearing all this, just like the Kalama Sutta, all the different people coming through the town, saying different things. So what do? We're kind of at a loss. So it's about spiritual authority. And the answer to who has spiritual authority is very much like who has authority in anything in the world, right? Why does a doctor have authority? Well, first of all, if he's a doctor, he's had a certain education. And he has probably been accredited by some kind of body which has decided that his education and training and everything is good enough. So now the person can be a doctor, right? This is the first thing here. It's like someone in the Buddhist world too, you need a certain, there's no formal accreditation, but often, if you are a monk, you consider chances are you might have some idea what this is about because you are living your life based on these things. So hopefully you have a little bit of idea of what the spiritual life is about. Or if you are a lay person, you've been doing it for a long time, same kind of thing. Yeah. So you have some kind of accreditation there. Yeah. But there's more to it than that. As a doctor, you might have the right formal requirements, but then still there is a difference between maybe a good doctor and a doctor who is not so good, and perhaps one who is outrightly bad, right? There's obviously going to be a vast spectrum among doctors, how good they are. Some are really, really excellent, some are maybe not so good. And it is the same, of course, in monastic life as well. There's going to be a vast spectrum. People become monastics or they become samanas, whatever, for all kinds of reasons. And many of those reasons are perfectly understandable, that these things have kind of grown up in societies. They act as teachers at colleges sometimes, or as school teachers in villages or whatever. So there's a great variety there. So you need some kind of criteria to decide which ones of these spiritual people actually have the, should we follow? Who should we really listen to? And a similar kind of thing with a doctor. After a while, you find out whether your doctor is really good or not. How do you find out? You find out because you see him many times. You compare him or her to others, right? And after a while, you get a feel for whether this person really has the qualities that they say they have. And it's exactly the same thing with a spiritual person. And this is what they're saying here. You actually watch them, right? You look at them and you see, do they have these states of greed, hatred, and delusion? And this is what this is saying. And if they, if you keep watching over a long period of time, and you are alert and you are wise yourself and you have enough awareness, you will be able to pick up whether they have these defilements in them, right? So you will see that. And when you see that, well, then you become a little bit more suspicious that maybe they haven't quite got the attainments or the understanding and wisdom that ideally a spiritual teacher should have. So this is the idea. You actually watch and you're aware of these things. So this is what the Buddha always says. And he says this also about himself, right? And this is what is so amazing about the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha said, well, you should actually watch me and you should see if I have any of these qualities. Right? This is in the Vimamsaka Sutta, number 47 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And he says, you should watch and then only really place faith when you see that those qualities are not there. So this is how we do it, and this is how you know whether confidence is rightly directed or wrongly directed towards anyone. You look for those qualities. Now, to me, the idea of someone being freed from lust, hate, and delusion is a little bit kind of theoretical almost, right? It's kind of, okay, how do you know whether someone is free of these things? It sounds a bit like, it's very hard to kind of pinpoint what that actually means. So remember that if you are free of these things, it has an effect on your conduct again, right? This is about what we were saying about before, perfect in vidyacharana sampanno, perfect in true knowledge and conduct. That it actually shows. So you will generally be kind, right? You will generally be compassionate. You will generally be understanding. You will generally be peaceful. You will have all these qualities. And you will be able to have those qualities even in circumstances that are usually distressing to other people, right? When other people kind of lose their balance, you will still be able to have your balance in a sense. And this is how you know these things over a long period of time. There will be a lot of good qualities. When you take away the bad ones, the good qualities kind of shine forth and become very powerful. So this is this is how you see this, at least to some extent. And then the minds who are inwardly peaceful, right? And again, you can usually, to a large extent, you can actually see that as well in a person. If you observe a person over a long time, you can actually know what the mental state is like. How are they? Are they peaceful? Again, it's the same kind of thing as we were just saying before. And you don't conduct yourself now righteously, now unrighteously. You always conduct yourself righteously, right? At least if you're an arahant, if you're fully awakened. These are the people you should revere. And why should you revere these people? Why should we listen to these people? What is the point of that? And of course, the point is that just like, if you go to a doctor to help you out, you go to the doctor because you have a problem, and the doctor can help you solve that problem in your life. And it's exactly the same thing with spiritual people. The point is that if someone is truly different from the rest of us, if someone is truly kind and compassionate and wise all the time, it is very obvious that they have something that we would like to, right? They have something there which we can learn from them. And this is why they're worthy of respect and worthy of honor, because they have something that we can learn. And if you want to learn from somebody, if you have somebody who can teach you something incredibly valuable, well, then that's why they're worthy of honor, right? Worthy of respect, because they have something that you actually want. And this is the point here. So you respect them for that reason, because they have something that you are hoping to learn from them. Okay, so and of course, if they are just like us, then you don't kind of respect them quite in the same way as a teacher, because somebody has to, they have to have some knowledge you don't have, otherwise they can't really teach you anything. Yeah. So that is the first part of this, how to find out whether decide whether someone is worthy to be your teacher or not. So that is about forms cognizable by the eye, and then we have the same thing going on for the other senses. So I'll just read through this fairly quickly. Those recluses and Brahmins who are not rid of lust, hate, and delusion, I don't think lust is such a good word, maybe desire simply or something like that, hate or delusion, regarding sounds cognizable by the ear, regarding odors cognizable by the nose, regarding flavors cognizable by the tongue, regarding tangibles cognizable by the body, regarding mind objects cognizable by the mind, whose minds are not inwardly peaceful, who conduct themselves now righteously, now unrighteously, in body, speech, and mind, should not be honored. Since we do not see any higher righteous conduct on the part of those good recluses and Brahmins, they should not be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. Being thus asked, householders, you should answer those wanderers of other sects in this way. So, basically, the reason they talk about the six senses in this way, because the six senses constitute the whole world, right? So basically, you have no desire, anger, or delusion in regard to anything. That's basically what it means. The whole world is included in this. And then we come to the opposite. Those people that can be venerated, the people that should be honored and respected because they can act as teachers. But householders, if the wanderers of other sects ask you thus, householder, what kind of recluses and Brahmins should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated? You should answer them thus. Those recluses and Brahmins who are rid of lust, hate, and delusion regarding forms cognizable by the eye, whose minds are inwardly peaceful, and who conduct themselves righteously in body, speech, and mind, such recluses and Brahmins should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated. Why is that? Because we ourselves are not rid of lust, hate, and delusion with regard to forms cognizable by the eye. Our minds are not inwardly peaceful, and we conduct ourselves now righteously, now unrighteously, in body, speech, and mind. Since we do see righteous conduct on the part of those good recluses and Brahmins, they should be honored, respected, revered, and venerated, because they have some magic that we can learn from them, some kind of training that can tame us and lead us to some profound happiness. That's basically what it comes down to, right? So somebody has got something, and you think, okay, I'm going to respect this person because hopefully I can learn something from them. And then we have the same for the other senses again. Those recluses and Brahmins who are rid of desire, ill will, and confusion regarding sounds cognizable by the ear, regarding odors cognizable by the nose, regarding flavors cognizable by the tongue, regarding tangibles cognizable by the body, regarding mind objects cognizable by the mind, whose minds are inwardly peaceful, and who conduct themselves righteously in body, speech, and mind, they should be honored, since we see higher righteous conduct on the part of those good recluses and Brahmins. They should be honored, revered, respected, and venerated. Being thus asked, householders, you should answer those wanderers of other sects in this way. So, I must admit, I feel the language here is a little bit too kind of stilted, perhaps. You know, I mean, who talks about tangibles cognizable by the body? It's not kind of ordinary language. It's a kind of, you can imagine the Buddha, when he was talking to these people, he would talk to them in a way where they could understand, right? Where it felt natural and they could actually relate to what he's saying. Not too elevated, not too low language, because then it's like putting the teaching down, but not so elevated that it feels alien to you. It should be a kind of language which resonates with you directly. And tangibles cognizable by the body is not kind of the kind of way that we normally speak. So I think this is one of the problems with translation, is to translate in such a way that it actually relates to you, resonates with you. So anyway, so you have to kind of see that in there. It means objects that you touch, right? Tangible. This is the tangible. I think it is the reason they have put it like that is because the Pali is potabba. Potabba means something which is to be touched. It means a tangible, an object of touch, basically. So like this, object of touch. Feeling. Yeah, feelings in the body. Yeah. But he's talking about the actual objects here. So it's actually the object that gives rise to the feelings. All your beloved objects. Okay, so also just very briefly, this idea of lust, hate, and delusion. Again, I don't think it is a great translation. First of all, lust is not really... I think greed is better, desire is better, because it's more broad-based. And this is a very broad-based idea of anything which is attractive to you, right? Anything which is attractive, anything you can have desire towards in the sensual world is what is included here. It's a very broad idea. Again, hate, I think, is far too strong a word. Ill will in all its manifestations, right, is what is meant here. And delusion, the last word, again, may not be perhaps the best word. The Pali word here is moha. And the idea of moha, avidya. Avidya is the root of dependent origination, the very first part of dependent origination, avidya. That's what we're trying to overcome. And the idea of avidya, of not understanding, has to do with the deep problems of not seeing impermanent suffering and non-self, right? But deluge, this word moha here, is more, again, much broader than that. It includes that idea, but it also includes all the kind of delusion in everyday life, the confusions, right? The restlessness, the mind being agitated, the mind kind of being clouded, and all these kind of things that we have in everyday life. This is part of what is delusion. Delusion here is the opposite of clarity, when the mind is clear and you feel peaceful and you can see things fairly clearly. That's what is meant here. Yes?
Arrogant.
Not this word, I think. Moha. I think you must be thinking of something different word. I think you're probably thinking about mada, perhaps. Mada, perhaps? Hate and delusion.
Arrogance.
I think that must be a different set of words, because arrogance is not appropriate translation for moha. Moha doesn't mean even remotely arrogance. It means a cloud. It could maybe include arrogance, because when you're arrogant, you're not seeing things very clearly, right? You're kind of caught up with your own kind of idea of superiority or something like that. So it may include that, but it's much, much broader than that. It has all to do with confusion, all these other kind of things as well. So arrogance is not the appropriate translation here. Lack of clarity here. Lack of understanding is deeper. Lack of understanding has more to do with wisdom. This is more lack of clarity. You know, sometimes your mind feels really clear, right? You go on a meditation retreat, your mind is so clear, and you feel peaceful, and you feel like you feel a kind of intuitive understanding of things in the world. You know what is right, what is wrong. Other times you're completely confused. Everything just seems, you have no idea what you're doing anymore sometimes. That's when it's very handy to have the precepts, right? When you're really confused, okay, at least I shouldn't be doing this. At least we can remember that much. But when your mind is clear, it's like you have an intuitive understanding what you should be doing and what you shouldn't. Then kindness becomes your only precept, and it's good enough in those situations. Yeah. So that's moha. And the reason for that is because moha is often used to be one of the roots of bad karma, and amoha, the roots of good karma. So it is much more broad than what we're talking about as vijja and avijja. So this is something like desire, ill will, and confusion might be a better translation of those three here. Anyway, that's just my ideas. So, okay, everybody happy so far? Yeah? Okay, good. So, now let us see, the Buddha then continues on, and he has more to say about how to decide who is worthy of honoring. In other words, who is worthy of being our teacher? Householders, if wanderers of other sects ask you thus, but what are your reasons and what are your evidence regarding those venerable ones, whereby you say of them, surely those venerable ones are either rid of lust or practicing for the removal of lust. They're either rid of hate or practicing for the removal of hate. They're either rid of confusion or practicing for the removal of confusion. Being asked thus, you should answer those wanderers of other sects thus. It is because those venerable ones resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest. For there are no forms cognizable by the eye there of a kind that they could look at it and delight in it. There are no sounds cognizable by the ear there of a kind that they could listen to and delight in it. There are no odors cognizable by the nose there of a kind that they could smell and delight in it. There are no flavors cognizable by the tongue there of a kind that they could taste and delight in it. There are no tangibles cognizable by the body there of a kind that they could touch and delight in it. These are our reasons, friends. This is our evidence whereby we say about those venerable ones, surely these venerable ones are either rid of desire, ill will, and confusion, or practicing for their removal. Being thus asked, householders, you should answer those wanderers of other sects in this way. So the point here is that sometimes it's hard to tell, right? I mean, if you are particularly if you have like a monastic as a teacher, sometimes the distance between the monastic community and lay community is quite large, right? You don't get to see people all the time. You maybe get to see someone like Ajahn Brahm once a week when it comes to Nova Mara or something like that. But there's still quite a bit of distance there. I mean, I live with, 24 monks every day. I see their conduct every day. So for me, it's easier to have some idea what the conduct is like. But sometimes it's not that easy for a lay person to see a monastic clearly, because there just isn't enough contact sometimes. Sometimes there is enough contact and you can know her, but sometimes there isn't. So sometimes you need kind of a starting point somewhere else to decide who is more likely to be worthy of respect. And this is the starting point here. If you haven't got enough information, well, at least, the Buddha says here, those monastics who actually live in the forest, who live away from the city, they are more likely to be rid of these things. Or at the very least, it is likely that they are practicing for getting rid of these things. Otherwise, they wouldn't live in the forest, right? If you are keen on sensuality, if you're keen on indulging in these things, it's pointless to live away in the forest somewhere. So this is the idea here. And one of the things I have always found quite fascinating with the suttas is the emphasis that actually is given in the suttas on dwelling in the forest. It is not just something you see just here. You see it in many different places. And one of the interesting ones is in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. This is the sutta of the Buddha's passing away, right? And the last journey of the Buddha, if I'm in the Digha Nikaya 16. And it tells the story of the Buddha. And of course, because this is the Buddha moving towards the end of his life, he's kind of summarizing his teachings, right? And giving kind of the last piece of advice to the monks and the nuns, and also to the lay people. And one of the things that he says in there, he talks about the seven things that will lead to the long lasting of the Sangha, long lasting of Buddhism in the future. And what are those seven things? I can't remember what they are, but I remember one of them. And one of them is, as long as the Sangha, the monastics, live in the forest, then Buddhism or the Dhamma will be a strong teaching that will last for a long time, right? And this is like the Buddha summarizing his life and summarizing the work of his life. And this is kind of what upholds the whole Dhamma, is to have a Sangha. It could be lay people as well, but certainly have someone who lives away from sensuality in the forest, where they can practice these teachings to the maximum possibility. So this shows you how important it is, right? This is one of those. Another one which, this was actually something pointed out to me by Ajahn Brahm a long, long time ago, but I have since read it in the sutta as is found in a number of places in the Anguttara Nikaya. You probably heard it before as well, but I think it's worth mentioning again. And this is where the Buddha is wandering around and is wandering. I think first of all he wanders into the near the villages, and on the edge of a village he sees this monk right, sitting and kind of perfectly in samadhi, very kind of looking very impressive, right? Very straight, very peaceful, all these kind of things. But then the amazing thing is that the Buddha says, "I'm not happy with that monk." This is what he says, right? "I'm not happy with that monk." And the reason he says is because he's so close to the village, he will sooner or later get distracted by people or by things which are distracting in the vicinity of the village. And this is kind of an amazing thing that you wouldn't expect. Normally we think, well, as long as you have the right meditation attitude, that's what really matters. But no, it's not just about having the right meditation. It's about being in a situation where you can improve further and you can go further along the path. It's not just about what you have now, but having the right circumstances to keep on moving forward. And then the Buddha goes into the forest, right? And this story is then he sees this monk in the forest, and monk kind of nodding away, really tired and really kind of things, right? And then the Buddha says, "Oh, I'm really happy with this monk." And he says that, and the reason why, he says, because this monk, because he's away from the village, because he's in the forest, he will dispel that tiredness, he will get rid of that through his meditation practice, and then he will be able to establish the samadhi afterwards. And it's a very powerful reminder that it matters, where we are. This idea of forest dwelling, again, is kind of mentioned there. And you find this idea in several places in the suttas. And here, What this sutta says, and one of the main points of this sutta, it tells you why it is so important to live in the forest. There are many reasons, but what this sutta says, one of the main reasons is to get away from sensuality. The world, the city world, city life, is basically a sensual life, right? It's very, you go around the city, everything is about sensuality, about enjoying yourself one way or another. Sometimes it's also about work, of course, but also about sensuality. This is one of the main reasons. Sometimes people think that the main reason for going into the forest is because it's peaceful and quiet. Of course, that's part of it. But actually, the main reason is probably to just withdraw, pull yourself out of sensuality, so you can get away from the things that distract the mind. And interesting, in the Chinese parallel to this particular sutta, there's a Chinese parallel to the sutta, and it has an addition there. It says, going into the forest, getting away from sensuality, and the main point there is to get away from the opposite gender. That's the main thing it talks about there. And of course, that is the main problem as far as sensuality is concerned. And again, that is why going into a monastery like that in the forest is very useful. You are away from that sort of contact that you would normally have in the city. And also why I think it's very good to have monasteries for monks and nuns quite separate, because that sort of gives that distance that is very useful on the spiritual path. So this is, again, this emphasis on the going to the forest, right? So if you ever have a chance, you want to go on a retreat, come to Jhana Grove and feel the forest environment in the retreat. Very beautiful over there in Jhana Grove, very nice. And you get a little bit of feeling for monastic life. If you're a monk, it's not so good because you have a cute in the forest, so Jhana Grove is still kind of crowded. But compared to city life, just go into nature, right, and be peaceful. It's still very it's very beautiful. Anyway, please, Hui Tong, yeah. Yeah. Okay. No, thank you for bringing that up. I actually want to talk about that. I think the translation here is a little bit overdone, in my opinion. What these words actually mean, they mean away from the city. They mean away from houses and people and the cities and towns. That's actually what it means. It doesn't necessarily mean far. Remote sounds like some kind of mountain somewhere far away, right? But I don't think that's what is meant here. What is meant is just that it's away from the cities and towns. And one of the reasons for that is because the monastics were always dependent on alms, right? They would have to go into the village or the town in the morning to collect alms. And they say the ideal distance is about 1 kilometer. So 1 kilometer it would be the average distance that would be away. So I think the translation there gives a little bit the wrong impression. It gives the idea that you really have to be far, far away. But the main idea is simply that you are away from those urban centers. That's basically the meaning there. But there's two things here. Remember that there's two aspects to this. And one is the idea that you are in the forest, as a community, like Bodhinyana Monastery. Another one is that you are in the forest as a solitary monk. So obviously, if you are talking about being a solitary monk or solitary nun in the forest, that is much more, it demands much more of your meditation abilities. If you are in a community, that is quite safe, but you're still away from the city, right? So there are degrees here. Because elsewhere the Buddha says that if you want to be completely solitary by yourself, you should have deep states of samadhi before you even do that. Okay, so that is the that part of it. So that's how you know. So monks, nuns in the forest is the ideal here. And then that's when you can expect that they are practicing. At the very least, they are practicing for the removal of these defilements. And then the people of Nagaravinda, then they say, When this was said, the Brahmin householders of Nagaravinda said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, holding up a light in the darkness for those with eyesight to see forms. We go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today, let Master Gotama accept us as lay followers who have gone to him for refuge for life." I like this. This last one here is quite. I'm not sure if those Brahmins actually said that, but this is kind of a very Buddhist sentiment, right? When you hear the Dhamma turning upright what was overthrown, in other words, it changes your view of the world almost 180 degrees, the Dhamma, when it kind of is fully absorbed. It's a complete inversion of what you usually thought was the case. Revealing what was hidden, right? Again, this idea of awakening to something. Something is hidden, something you haven't seen before. You now see for the first time the veil. The veil is taken away from the world. You can see the world clearly here. Showing the way to one who is lost, right? Getting back on track, knowing what you have to do here. Getting back on the path, the Noble Eightfold Path. There's two paths. There's a Noble Eightfold Path and the wrong Noble... The wrong Eightfold Path. The right Eightfold Path and the wrong Eightfold Path. You want to get on the right one here. Holding up a lamp in the darkness, right? This is what the idea of awakening is about. You can see for the first time. You have a light, holding up a light in the darkness. I think that we have a Russian speaker. Do you speak Russian, Tatiana? Yeah? So, Buddha, can you say Buddha in Russian? It means awake, right? Yeah. So this is quite interesting, because this is obviously the same word in Russian that actually comes from Sanskrit in India. It has been transferred because it's all the same language group, Indo-European language group. And in Russia, in Russian language, it still means awake to this day. Yeah. So that's fascinating here. Yeah. So there you have. So you wake, right? You see the forms for the first time. Darkness is dispelled. You wake up. So very kind of nice ideas here. And it shows you how profound it is, right? It's an eye-opener. It's drawing away the veil, turning on the light. There's something very powerful about the Dhamma, which changes your perspective on things. And that change of perspective, of course, brings with it the happiness at the same time, the ending of suffering and problems, and the movement towards happiness and peace and all these things. It's an amazing thing. It's very inspiring, isn't it? I find it very inspiring. It's nice to read about this. So, yes, Huitong here. Yeah. Please, yeah. 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 Well, this is the thing. I think what you have to do there is that these things are not absolute, right? There's no absolute truth. So sometimes it may be that you can find sitting monks and nuns who are exceptional. And perhaps they came from the forest and did all the hard work there. And they came to the city, now they're teaching in the city. So there's nothing is ever absolute. And you find many, I'm sure you find many scallywags in the forest as well, right? But this is a general guideline. It's a general thing which is there. So be careful not to judge people 100%. Always have a little bit of open mind there. Otherwise, you're going to make a mistake. And the other thing is that even though you may not be kind of a great meditator in a city monastery or whatever, still, you may have other abilities. You may be useful in other ways, right? You can teach the suttas. It's amazing how well you can teach the suttas just from learning the suttas, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that you are very advanced, but you can still give very inspiring teachings and good teachings. Yeah, so don't be too judgmental. Yeah. 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 Sure. Yeah. I think that there is mentioned in the Vinaya Pitaka, there is mentioned the idea of monastics dwelling in the towns and the cities. At the time of the Buddha, is there anywhere mentioned? I think the closest is the monk who's sitting on the edge of the village in Samadhi. That's the closest, I think, closest to get. I can't remember anything more than that. Right. That's the Gulisana Sutta, Majjhima 69. And I think that was a monk who was living by himself in the forest. That's a slightly different thing here. He was a solitary monk. But most of the monasteries at the time of the Buddha, for example, you had the Antapindika's monastery in Savatthi, you know, the Jetavana. That was on the edge of the city, right? So just outside the city. So it was easy, 500 meters or a kilometer to walk in, right? And you go to, if you go to Rajagaha, you see the same thing. The Veluvana, the bamboo grove, would be just outside the monastery. The Gijakuta was like on the mountain, but not very far away. Have you been to India, Buddha? You haven't been there? Okay. Time to come. So, Gijakuta, very beautiful place, very inspiring place when you go there. You can sort of overlook the city, overlook the valley, you see the valley down. That's where the old city of Rajagaha was before. So the Buddha wouldn't have been that far away here. I think the word remote doesn't, the Pali word doesn't mean remote at all. It means kind of outside or something like that. So that makes that's an important point, I think. Indeed, and it wasn't that far away from the city, so that's exactly right. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Chris, do you have questions? I'll give it.
Having a very comfortable sort of comfort zone in the practice of the Dharma. And then, you know, you go to the meditation retreats and, you know, oh God, I haven't got this and I haven't got that. But, you know, what you're really saying is that it's you know, it's really, really important to actually make the effort to get away from work or wherever it is for that 1 or 2 weeks per year, because I can see how you can just start telling little fairy stories to yourself over the years that you're really practicing the Dharma when you're actually just going off into being sucked into the world again, like you were talking about with the monk who's on the edge of the city going through the motions, but actually he's actually going downhill.
And
I think that can happen in lay life very easily, where we actually just go through the motions of coming here to the centre. But, you know, inside we're stagnating or turning to stone. And it seems to me like it's a very important part to make the effort to get the hell out of my comfort zone on a regular basis and submit myself to stillness through, you know, some fairly solid, intensive retreats.
Yeah, I think it's very useful. The Buddha also says that specifically in one of the suttas. He speaks to Anathapindika, and he says that, you know, you too, as a householder, you should occasionally go away and separate yourself and experience this, the piti, which is born of seclusion, which basically means samadhi experience. That's what he says. So I think indeed it's very, very useful. And I think in those days, city life was pretty simple compared to what it is now, you know. In those days, it was pretty kind of easy. But now it's a very completely different kettle of fish, much more enmeshing probably than it was in those days.
Especially with smartphone, you just can't be anywhere. No, seriously, it's a really big deal. It's a really big deal. And I know some of the other monks, what's the chap in Northern England, but he talks about having a data fast one day, once a week. Because smartphones got the capacity to just be everywhere and give you the sense of being connected even when you're on the top of a mountain, and to actually turn off that smartphone. You've only got to sit on a Friday night here. How much anxiety people have with actually daring to turn off their mobile phone.
Mm.
But actually what I was going to ask you was, do you think that if you're a practitioner and a layperson, that sooner or later you should make some sort of like range retreat type commitments to, you know, hang out for like a 3-month period and that sort of stuff? I'm sort of feeling the need to maybe clear the cobwebs away and do something a bit more than just the odd week here and week there. And I'm just wondering whether that's something that you would recommend for people who are, you know, fairly seriously into it.
Yeah. It depends on who you are. It depends on where you are in your practice. It depends on so many factors. You can't generalize anything, unfortunately. There's no... Basically, it just depends. And the way to find out is just to go to the monastery for a week or two and see what happens, right? And then if you enjoy it and you think it's a good thing, then maybe a range of retreat will be good for you. But it's not something that I would say that everyone should do. It just depends on... It should be quite natural. It should be a feeling of ease over it, right? If you push yourself too much, you won't feel any ease in going to the range retreat. It's quite tough to spend the range retreat in the monastery. Then you are really talking about renunciation, almost monastic style, you know, when you do that. It's quite tough. You don't talk to many people. It's very quiet for 3 months. It's not going straight from that, from lay life to that, can be quite hard for many, many people. So if it is natural for you, if it feels like this is what you can do, and you can do without too much internal resistance, and this is what often happens, people have too much internal resistance, then please, it's a wonderful thing to do. But I would never recommend it to do it as some kind of practice just because, you know, you heard it's good. You have to take charge of yourself, look at whether it actually works for you. If it works for you, great. If it doesn't, please don't push yourself.
Yeah, I noticed your comment about the Buddha's comment that you just don't go off into the woods and do it unless you've got decent samadhi.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's in the Anguttara Nikaya. The Buddha says, have you got first jhana, second jhana? No? Okay, stay in the sangha. Don't go by yourself. Mm. Yeah.
Is it very easy to actually renounce the 5 aggregates but get totally absorbed in the 6 aggregate, which then end up very easily heading you towards psychosis, you know, just be totally in the
sixth sense space, I mean, yeah.
You know, off the planet sort of people that are, you know, on the, you know, you can see that a lot in India.
Yeah, but the reason is because you haven't actually renounced the other 5 sense spaces. You think you have, but you haven't. You're actually just pushing them away here, and you're forcing them out, but they're still actually, you still crave them, you still need them in a sense. So you have to be ready to actually ban those things, right? This can't be done through an act of force. It has to come naturally here. And this is the problem. The path should be a natural development. And this is why it's beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. You should see, how do you feel about the practice? Does it feel at ease? Do you feel comfortable with it? Do you feel that the bad qualities are declining and you're actually feeling more happy and the things are going the right way? Then you know it's good, right? That's what it should feel like. But too many people use too much force and too much kind of gritting their teeth and too much willpower and not doing stuff that they're not ready for. So you have to, essentially, when you go to a teacher and ask for questions, I would say the teacher should really, ideally, throw it back to you to decide whether you're ready or not. Don't follow the teacher too blindly. If some of the teacher can give very direct advice, you should be doing this. But I think, generally speaking, it's very, very difficult for a teacher to know exactly where you're at. Occasionally, they might get it right, but it's also very easy to get wrong. So make sure you feel comfortable with it, and only then should you actually do something like that. Otherwise, you might end up damaging yourself or whatever. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So could this piece of sutta have been spoken in the early phase of the enlightenment, whereby still in this fledgling?
This is a standard phrase that you find throughout the suttas, and I don't think it means remote. So I don't think I think that's the problem. The problem is that it doesn't actually mean remote. It just means outside. So I think the translation is the problem there, and not actually the phrasing of the Pali. But this is a standard phrasing that you find pretty much everywhere in a sutta. Vana, how does it go again? Aranya vana patani Pantani, Sanasanani, and all of those words mean forest or just removed from the town, right? Havadiya, removal. Aranya is a wilderness, not of the king, quite literally. Vana is wood. Patta is a similar kind of word, wood or woodland. And Pantani is like secluded or away from. So they all have that idea of just forest or wilderness or being apart from something. They don't actually, none of those words actually mean remote. So it's just it's a translation issue.
So the issue is just to be away from the village or the city.
That's what it means. That's what it means, yeah. Okay. Anybody else want to say anything? Yes, please. Yeah. Yeah.
But the same as just the English use of the word, like to reclude, to sort of withdraw? Or is it, in this context, is it sort of more like to go away from the worldly life, from the householder, to being a monk or something?
Yeah. The Pali word is samana. And the word samana means precisely that. It basically means a renunciant. Someone has renounced the world. That's what it actually means. So renunciant is probably a better translation, because not all the samanas were recluses. They hadn't all kind of, they weren't all kind of sitting in caves or anything like that. Some of them were living in communities, like we do in Bodhinyana Monastery. We're still relatively secluded, but not completely secluded. So I think a renunciant is a good translation. Sometimes ascetic is a translation, because obviously you lead a slightly more ascetic life. But samana is the Pali word behind it.
Thanks for the clarification.
You are welcome. Yeah. Anything else before we call it a day? Everybody okay? Okay, so let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.